This is Interested, a podcast about interesting things for interested people. Yeah. I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Beth.
Yeah, we're best friends and we both come from very different aspects of interest, but we wanted to bridge a gap between the arts and the sciences, come together, share our different passions, and hopefully you also get to learn some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, fun time. So I'm really into literature and psychology and history.
I'm super into science, maths, and also art.
So we're just going to pick a topic every week and talk about our area and hopefully educate, have some fun, drink some wine when it's the evening.
Yeah.
Hydrate yourself.
Yeah.
If you haven't had a glass of water, perhaps sit down, listen to us.
A warning,
Enrich your life.
There will be swearing if you aren't a fan of that. This may not be the podcast for you.
Not the one.
If that's all fine, sit down, enjoy yourself.
Yes, welcome.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you about Nikola Tesla.
Ooh.
So, he was an inventor. He was an electrical engineer, and he's best known for basically inventing the AC motor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what gives us all electricity in our houses and very important. He was born in the mid 19th century, and he was super super smart. He came from a well educated family. His mum obviously wasn't educated because but she invented home appliances and she could memorize Serbian epics, which are super long poems. I don't know much about them, but
they're very long.
Yeah.
I think he's read 12 books.
Oh my gosh.
I think the Iliad is 24 books. Very long.
It's very long.
Yeah.
And he credits her with his genius.
Wow.
And eidetic memory, which is a photographic memory.
Cool.
So yeah. He was super smart. He's also known as being a little bit arrogant.
Mm. You kind of would be if you were that clever, though.
Yeah, exactly. He had very striking looks. He had piercing blue eyes and really dark hair. And he was 6'2", but only 64 kilograms.
Oh my gosh. So just big and
long.
Long
and thin.
And thin.
And part of the reason is because, although back then he was just seen as eccentric, now from a look from hindsight, we think actually he probably had very high functioning autism, and also he definitely suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. Everything he did had to be divisible by 3. Before he ate, he'd have to fold 18 napkins.
Oh my gosh.
Every morning he'd get up, he'd go swimming, and he had to do 27 laps.
Yeah.
Obviously divisible by 3.
Ooh.
He would, whenever he ate, he would calculate the precise, mass, cubic mass of the food he was eating.
Oh my gosh.
And the precise number of jaw movements required to digest it.
So laborious.
Yeah, obviously really, really struggling.
Yeah.
And obviously people just didn't pick up on that because...
As a real disorder that needed help.
Yeah.
It's just quirky that...
No.
Oh, it's really sad.
Yeah, and he suffered multiple nervous breakdowns throughout his life.
Yeah.
And he had a profound fear of round things. And he hated women's earrings, and he was the sight of a peach would bring on a fit.
Wow.
He also was really worried about germs, so he didn't like shaking hands.
Yeah.
He was I would touch another person's hair only at the point of a revolver.
Yeah, really.
But he was also known for being a great showman. He was really theatrical, great at giving talks about his inventions. So he was actually quite well liked.
But obviously he just suffered with crippling OCD.
Yeah. I'm very anxious.
Sad.
And yeah, so he came from a religious family, and he had I think 4 siblings. One of them died, but he was quite well educated because his father was a priest. So after high school, he came back home. He was going to be a priest, but then he caught cholera.
Oh no!
Really ill. He was in bed for like 9 months.
Yeah.
Close to death. One of the occasions, his dad was like, "Listen, if you get better, I will send you to an engineering school."
Miraculously.
And then miraculously, he got better. I think he just
probably
got better.
He just got better. Yeah. But
I doubt he was faking it for 9 months.
No.
So yeah, he gets sent to university in Graz, which is in Austria, and he starts off really well. He's an A-star student, never misses a lecture. He completed 9 exams, which is twice the required amount. So yeah, really. And his father received 2 letters, one of which praised his son for being a star pupil. The other was not found until his father died, and if you don't remove your son from university, he's going to work himself to death.
Oh my gosh. That's so
yeah. And
that's so funny.
Yeah. Just, oh my gosh.
Also, Tesla, take a break.
Yeah, well, he continued, he would have, 2 hours sleep a night.
Oh,
and he continued this throughout his life.
God.
So yeah, it started off great, but quickly went downhill after the first year. He lost his scholarship, he got addicted to gambling.
Tesla!
I know.
I always find that crazy. How can you be that clever and then give in to such a terrible, reckless
I think it's just hobby. You know, addictions are just...
Addictions? Okay. Yeah. If you've got a gambling addiction, go get some help for that, because it's really damaging, and it's just as much of a...
Addiction as smoking.
Yeah.
I feel like... I never go near gambling because I know that I could get addicted to it.
Really?
Yeah, I have that urge.
Oh gosh, stay away.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
So yeah, also what contributed to this was he became disillusioned with his teachers.
Yeah.
Because one specific occasion, his teacher was demonstrating a gram machine. And a gram machine has these rings called commutators and metal brushes. And they were sparking, and Tesla basically said, there must be a better way without all this sparking. There must be a way to have an AC motor, basically. And the teacher gave a hour-long lecture on why Tesla was wrong. At the end, he was like, Tesla may do many great things, but this, meaning creating an AC motor, will not be one of them. It's a perpetual motion machine. And a perpetual motion machine,
it's like a big science diss.
Yeah, it's basically meaning it's impossible, you're an idiot.
Oh, so humiliating.
Yeah, and Tesla said he was really humiliated by this.
Sorry, he heard a beep just
So yeah, he said, I was really humiliated by this, but he still kept thinking about, because the sparking, and ineffective and inefficientness of it really bugged him, so
he had to fix it.
So yeah, basically after this it just went downhill really quick. He eventually gambled away all his money. He eventually gambled it back and repaid his family, but by this time he dropped out of university, and he was so embarrassed about dropping out that he moved away. His friends thought he'd drowned and nearby river.
Oh my gosh.
His dad had to come find him and drag him home.
Oh no.
Which, although it's the circumstances were not great, the way he got him home. I was actually thank God, because his dad actually died later that year.
Oh yeah.
So it would have been really tragic if he hadn't come home then.
Yeah, definitely. And then...
So, but yeah, so skipping forward quite a bit, he eventually gets a job in the Edison Continental Company. Mm-hmm. And he's working on electric lighting systems. So this is where he basically learns about electrical engineering.
Yeah.
and this job leads to him being relocated to New York.
Ooh.
Yeah,
exciting. Big city times.
Where he works at Edison Machine Works, so like he's like Edison's his boss now.
Yeah.
And event at the start, he's like, he respects Edison so much because obviously he's like really famous, and it's like, wow, this guy never had a formal education.
Yeah, wow.
And he's just grown like this huge company. But quickly they start, like, there's a really nice description of them where they're like, where it's like Edison and Tesla were like oil and water.
Oh no.
Both were amused and irritated by each other.
Oh basically. My gosh. They didn't mix.
They did not mix. Yeah, because Tesla saw Edison as like his method. He's very experimental, so he would just try every possible way to do something until he found the right one. I think there was actually, no, there was a great one where it was like, if Edison and Tesla were both tasked with like finding a needle in a haystack, Tesla was like, Edison would sit down and dutifully pick through every single bit of straw before he found the needle.
Oh my gosh.
And Tesla would not have picked through the entire haystack. Like, I could be sure of that. He was famous for having this imagination that was so powerful that he never needed to draw out his inventions. He could just picture them in his head to such a precise detail that he would just need to write down a list of measurements and components, send these off to the factory, and when they came back, they would just fit together perfectly and straight away. So he very much saw Edison as inefficient and wasting time with all these countless experiments. So yeah, and that's quite true, but yeah, Edison never had an education, so...
Yeah, so that's how you would learn, by experimenting.
So because of this,
Tesla was like, that's so inefficient, probably.
Yeah, literally, and he was really annoyed by this. So yeah, after about six months, Tesla quit. Because he quit after there was a misunderstanding about bonuses.
Mm.
He felt that he was owed. And the stories differ on this. But the story I'm going to go with is that either the manager or Edison himself offered a $50,000 bonus to anyone who could design 24 different types of standard machines. And Tesla did that and then was like, okay, can I have some money? And they were like, oh no, it was a joke.
What?
Yeah. So Tesla,
like, what?
In Tesla's thing, it very much sounds like, what? And he quotes Edison as saying, Tesla, you just don't understand our American humour. But $50,000 was more than that, like, department of the company would have had on hand.
Right, okay.
So it probably was a joke.
And he just took it literally.
And he found some... He got some other people to back him financially and start, like, a company.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, these guys screwed him over. Basically stole... He designed some lighting and they basically just stole his ideas, and he was left penniless. No. This led to him digging ditches for $2 a day.
Well, that's just mad that a brain like that...
Literally, he was like... It felt like a mockery that all of his education in science, mechanics, literature, philosophy... And, like, was all wasted.
That's so sad.
And so he was doing this for quite a while until one day, like, someone realised, oh, wait, this guy's really smart. And they set him up with some guys called, like, Brown and Peck. Those are their surnames, but... who backed him, and then, you know, some stuff happened. That's when he, like, designed the AC motor and built it, and also a transformer, which steps voltage up and down, which is important.
Makes it less dangerous.
Yeah, because obviously if you're transferring electricity over a long distance, you want high voltage, because that means that less, like, there's less, the current's lower, so there's less heat loss, less resistance, but if you have high voltage, it will fry your light.
Yeah, yeah.
So you need to step up and down.
Yeah.
And Westinghouse, who, George Westinghouse was a competitor of Edison.
Yeah.
And he basically saw Tesla's ideas and was like, oh, this looks really good. He bought...
An entrepreneur just jumped on it.
Yeah. He was... I mean, he wasn't... Yeah, yeah, basically.
Okay.
I'll do a different episode where I talk about him.
Okay.
But yeah, so he bought Tesla's patent for $60,000 in cash and stock in his own company.
That's so much money.
And also gave Tesla a royalty slip of $2.50 per AC horsepower generated by each motor.
What?
Crazy. Think of all the AC motors. Because all of our motors are AC now, pretty much.
Wow.
Like, if you think DC... So if you think of batteries, those are DC. If you think of electricity in a plug socket, that's AC.
So, like, there's literally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plug sockets here. Yeah,
literally.
So 6 times £2, whatever, $2 or whatever.
Yeah.
That's so much money.
A lot of money.
Wow.
So...
Mad.
Westinghouse also hired Tesla, but it didn't last very long because there were issues, and also Tesla didn't get on very well with the engineers. But Westinghouse kept, like, sort of funding Tesla a little bit in his later life, but, like, just paying for his expenses and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Westinghouse was, like, a really good dude.
Yeah.
I won't go into it too much, but he was like really good at paying everyone a living wage at a time where no one else was.
Mm. 100%.
He was just like, he wanted to support people in like the American ideal of building wealth for themselves, but he was obviously like, well, if I don't pay them a living wage, they can't get anywhere.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
really good. He was a really good dude.
And that was super rare in that time.
Yeah,
I did
super rare.
History in that exact time period, and they really did not treat their workers well in any way.
No.
The businesses really had like vices on workers, and it's like massive problem.
And so he was a competitor of Edison, and this led to something called the War of the Currents.
So exciting!
I know. So basically, at this time, Edison was really invested in DC electricity.
Yeah.
So they'd had DC motors for a long time. DC stands for direct current. And DC cannot be stepped up and down. So the voltage has to stay the same.
Mm.
So obviously, they had to have the voltage running at a low, like, at a low voltage.
Yeah.
But that meant it could only be transferred about a mile from the power station.
Yeah, inefficient.
So Edison had built in New York a grid of power stations, like with every mile.
Oh no.
New power station.
That's not efficient in any way.
No, and the
really expensive.
The wires were like as thick as your arm.
Oh my gosh.
So, and also they were made of copper, and there was a copper shortage.
Shit!
So Westinghouse was obviously like, this is not gonna be the future.
No.
Yeah. He bought Tesla's.
America isn't in a city.
Yeah, it was mainly rural at this time.
Yeah, hugely rural.
And Edison was not really worried about Tesla because Tesla was really naive. He wasn't a good businessman. He was worried about Westinghouse. Westinghouse had like other successful businesses. He was like, this is not good. So he started a negative press campaign.
He was like the business mind.
Yeah, definitely.
To be reckoned with. Yeah.
Yeah. And he also had a lot of money.
Mm.
So he could.
Was he like born in money? Do you know?
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I
was just wondering.
He.
Or whether he was self-made.
He invented air brakes for trains.
Oh.
So before this is Westinghouse. Before Westinghouse's brakes, if the engineer driving the train wanted to stop the train because there was something on the tracks, he'd have to go through every carriage individually and manually put the brakes on.
Whoa, that's not good.
Yeah.
Wow, so that's really
So Westinghouse
really
made the air brakes. And
also, historically, the railways were massively important in this
super
time.
Super important.
Really big business.
And
reaching the West was really important through
and
trains.
And because the railways were so shit to him when he was designing this air brake. When he designed it, he was like, I'm not going to license you to build this. You're going to have to come to me if you want air brakes and buy them all from him. He's going to build them. So he earned a lot of money from that.
He kind of monopolised the train brake.
Yeah, definitely.
Line. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Clever.
Mm.
Yeah. Also a big fuck you.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But he wanted to make sure people were safe, so.
Yeah.
Cool dude. He was. I was like, I didn't know very much until I researched him in this episode.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's super cool.
That's cool.
Anyway, where was I? War of the Currents. So yeah, Edison started his negative press campaign, where basically, it didn't show Edison in the best light.
Yeah.
He basically wanted to show people how dangerous AC current was.
Yeah, which is what Tesla was backing and created himself. Yeah.
Yes. And so he did this in some cases by electrocuting animals.
Oh.
To show how it killed people.
Oh no.
Also when
the ethics.
I know, when the electric chair was invented, because there were some botched hangings and the politicians went to Westinghouse and they were like, listen, will your AC current kill people? And he was like, yeah, that'd be a really efficient way of killing people.
Like, shit, not good press for your company though.
Yeah, so the electric chair,
best way to kill someone.
Edison obviously jumped on that. And there are two ways to look at this. The first is very cynical. Edison was just doing this to destroy his competition.
Yeah, he's the dickhead of the story.
Yeah. You know, he was just being a businessman. The other way is to think, at this time, a lot of people were actually dying.
Yeah.
So in New York, there weren't as many regulations as in other places to do with... So the electric lines carrying AC were just strung up everywhere.
Yeah.
They were not properly installed. They were not properly insulated.
Also, like, tenement buildings at the moment in the cities, so in New York, were just so packed with, you know, Irish immigrants and Jewish immigrants. And it was squalor. Like, it was not... Kind of near to a slum kind of level of really bad living standards. Really cheap buildings thrown up.
But yeah, so at this time, a lot of people were actually dying. Because you have to remember the voltage in the wires before it went to transformers and was stepped down was 6,000 volts.
Oh my gosh.
Which is definitely enough to kill someone.
Yeah.
So the less cynical way to look at it is Edison was genuinely scared and genuinely thought, this is really dangerous, we shouldn't be using this, and thought, I need to show people, how can I do that? Well, I can't electrocute a person to show them how quickly it kills someone. Next best thing is an animal.
Mm.
Obviously, problematic as fuck.
Not great.
I think it was...
Very relevant to what I'm going to talk about later, though.
Oh, exciting. Eventually, Tesla and AC wins the War of the Currents because there's this big show called the Columbian World Exhibition.
Right.
And they're having a huge light show. And basically, business shenanigans, I'm not going to go into it, but Westinghouse...
War of the Currents again, wasn't it?
Yeah. Westinghouse's, like, price for lighting the exhibition was a lot lower than Edison's.
Yeah.
So he got
the job.
And there were no deaths. It all worked off. I know. Because all the wires were installed properly.
Yeah.
It worked fantastically. It was a huge, like, public and marketing success. People realised actually AC was... they saw that it was reliable. And later this year, the Niagara Falls Power Company chose AC and Tesla's designs for their power plant there.
Yay! That's really good investment.
Yes. So, obviously, that kind of started the whole... Mm-hmm. Like, by that time, AC was the accepted use of current. Even Edison's company had switched to AC.
Wow.
So Tesla won the War of the Currents.
Yay! Oh boy, Tesla!
Um,
although you were saying earlier, because
we have actually spoken about all of this.
Yeah. Just the second recording.
This is the second time, but it's fine.
Because you were saying earlier that Edison is vilified.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of because he lost, and because obviously he did that really not great publicity.
He's seen as, like, very much a money-grabbing, like, businessman. He actually was not that interested in money. So he wanted money so that he could keep inventing. Invention was his life's work. And it is very easy to see him as, like, the capitalist.
Greedy. Yeah.
Like... He was a human. He did a lot of good as well. Like, he's actually a really complicated guy. And he's definitely not the kind of...
the stock villain that we all think.
No, perhaps. Definitely not.
Mm.
So where was I in Tesla's life?
So he's won the War of the Currents.
Yeah.
But didn't he... tore up his patent thing?
Oh my gosh, yeah,
So he won, but
basically before AC was accepted, Westinghouse's company was starting to, you know, really it was taking its toll from all the bad
Edison
press.
Was winning at that point.
Yeah, and Westinghouse basically went to Tesla and he was like, look, I think our company is gonna go bankrupt.
Mm.
And so Tesla tore up the royalty slip of $2.50 per AC horsepower by each motor. And, which, you know, saved Westinghouse's company, arguably meant that he saw his dream fulfilled, but left him penniless.
Oh, Tesla.
I know, it's really sad. What a
horrible roller coaster of a life. And then all the while, he's probably having to do his OCD.
Yeah.
Rituals just to feel safer and
yeah, definitely.
This was probably a time where that got worse.
The last big project that he tried to do was a big like wireless communication tower at a place called Wardenclyffe. And basically he initially got funding, but then from JP Morgan. JP Morgan basically he pulled out. And Tesla tried to get funding from other people, but like by this time people kind of saw his ideas as increasingly eccentric, which is ironic because they're ideas that now we're actually using in current technology.
Oh really?
So he's just too ahead of his time. And so he didn't get any backing. He eventually had to scrap Wardenclyffe to pay for debts. He spent the rest of his life just travelling around hotels, leaving unpaid bills. Although Westinghouse Corporation did kind of cover a bit of his expenses.
Yeah.
And he really, like, just... yeah, he really retreated within himself because he felt like the world had just fucked him over one too many times.
It's really sad.
And, yeah, and so he started feeding loads of pigeons as well. Yeah.
A pigeon boy.
Because like he's just pure and
animals and don't turn your back on you.
Yeah. Ooh. And there was one pigeon in particular who was a white female who he said he loved almost as one would love a human.
Oh, that's really sad.
Yeah.
But lovely.
And then eventually there's a super sad story of the pigeon dying in his arms.
Mm.
And then he was like, and that was when I knew my life's work was complete.
That's so,
I know.
So pretty, but
and,
sad.
So yeah, he died penniless. But
that's just mad, isn't it?
His technology survives. And I'm going to tell you a bit about his technology now. Because I want to say a bit about his legacy. So during the War of the Currents, not only was he winning the War of the Currents, although arguably Westinghouse was winning it.
Yeah, because he had the brains of it, of the business brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the money.
And the money, yeah.
And Tesla was still inventing things. So he invented the Tesla coil, which is what all radio and TV broadcasting relies on. And
It makes it so sad that he literally died penniless.
I know.
And all of his inventions are in use.
Well, this is just another example of how he got screwed over.
Yeah.
So this guy, Marconi, is often credited as the father of radio. Unfortunately, I'm not going to dislike the work he did, because I haven't researched it, but I bet like he did do some significant like improvements in the field. Unfortunately, he did so using Tesla's patents.
No.
And he did not didn't credit him at all.
It's just not good.
No. Oh,
that's not ethical in any way.
No, and Tesla tried to like file a lawsuit against him, but it wasn't till after Tesla died that the US Supreme Court was like, yeah, he was the inventor.
The American government is I know. So bad.
I think it was like 1943 that they were like, oh, sorry. Yeah.
So annoying.
He also invented x-rays.
Wow.
So there's a really cool picture of like an x-ray of his hand.
We'll put it on the Instagram.
Yes.
Yeah.
So another interesting thing, this kind of, I'll get back to the inventions in a minute,
yeah.
But another link with Marconi is that, so one thing you might read when if you research Tesla is that he believed in aliens.
What?
Which is like, it's based on in, when basically Tesla was working on his radio, he received signals, and obviously at this time you have to remember there was no one, he didn't think that there was anyone else using radio.
Yeah.
Like, because it was a brand new invention, which is just crazy to imagine.
Yeah, that there was no other radio.
And he interpreted, like, I think it was in Morse code or something.
Yeah.
Like a electrical impulse. And he just assumed that it was from another planet.
Mm.
And reporters jumped on this and they were like, oh my God, this is sensational. Tesla believes in messages from Mars.
Dear.
He actually clarified later that he didn't specify it was Mars.
Yeah.
And
rude.
B, he didn't say that he was like sure that it was intelligent communication.
Yeah.
It could have just been like communication is not.
Yeah, it's
like
not.
It's he said he
Hi.
Received. Yeah.
So I'm an alien.
Yeah,
it's
that's
just
not
interference, isn't it?
Yeah, it Other was ways. He it was just like a signal which obviously was not natural.
Yeah.
So yeah, but basically what we think happened, and I say we, I mean historians and scientists who are smarter than me.
Yeah.
what they think happened was that he actually intercepted some of Marconi's experiments.
Oh, wow.
Or another experimenter, like, using wireless technology.
Yeah.
And he didn't know about the other experiments, so he just was like, well,
you would assume that it's aliens, like, what?
Yeah, why not?
That's pretty cool that...
Yeah.
Holy shit, this is an alien!
Yeah.
But obviously the press were like, whoa!
Yeah, and, like, it's a bit... Yeah. Because actually, originally, like, because I knew about Tesla way before, like, researching this, but in the documentary I originally watched, I'm pretty sure there it did say that he was going mad, and that's why he believed in... And it wasn't actually that. But yeah, so other inventions, like, remote control, he also did, like, neon lighting, just a crazy amount of stuff. But yeah.
So influential, but so sad that he died penniless. And
definitely.
Got fucked over so many times.
Yeah.
Nice.
I think that's where my bit is ending.
I'm bringing Frankenstein today.
So cool.
Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, for everyone who doesn't know. So I'm going to first talk about what mainly people will think when they first think of Frankenstein. They'll think of a big monster who is called Frankenstein. That's not actually correct. The monster isn't called Frankenstein. Frankenstein is the creator of the monster. Just to clear that up, because people get that mixed around, because cinema and film have really skewed our ideas of the story, which is not accurate, unfortunately.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's really
I know, like, a little bit.
Yeah.
I know enough to be excited.
Yeah. Yeah, so just a run through the plot, first of all. The book starts with a traveller who is in the Arctic looking for He's got like a scientific venture himself. He's called Walton. And he then picks up Victor Frankenstein, who is chasing the beast. So we begin at the end of the story, really. Oh. And the narrative follows what's called a concentric narrative, where so we start in the circle of Walton's narrative, who's writing back home to his sister. And then Frankenstein, he gets picked up by Walton, and he tells his whole story, which is, you know, the main part of the book. And then later on, the beast that he creates has like 7 whole chapters of his own narrative. Oh, yeah, which is really interesting because, as I was talking about earlier, our idea of the monster is he's called Frankenstein, but also he can't speak. He's just a grunting, horrible monster who roams everywhere. But in the book, completely different. He can speak eventually. He learns how to read and write even.
So he's actually far more human, like.
Far more human, yeah. Which is, I'll go on to how ironic that is, but yeah, it's a bit problematic because the actual monster is really quite educated by the time he comes back to Frankenstein. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So the plot really is that Victor Frankenstein is this very passionate, ambitious scientist who learns about galvanism, which is where electricity is put through a body, and the idea is that you could reanimate a dead limbs of corpses and it can become a being. So yeah, so he basically goes into it's kind of grim really, and I'm going to talk about the themes of it later, but he goes into what is called charnel houses, which are basically where dead corpses are put before they're put in the ground, to collect body parts to create this monster, which is kind of, it foreshadows how, maybe he shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
It's really not.
Don't steal dead people's
minds. Yeah, and it's also quite relevant because contextually, scientists and especially surgeons and medic students were, you know, they had to get dead bodies to learn anatomy. That was often done through what was known as grave diggers.
Yeah, because they didn't have any preservatives.
Yeah, so they had to get, you know, fresh bodies, which was, you know, it's pretty grim. It's quite controversial having to re-dig up bodies to dissect them.
Probably illegal.
Yeah, really illegal. So yeah, grave digging was illegal. So this is also comes into the fact that what Victor Frankenstein is doing is not great morally.
Yeah.
So yeah, he works and he slaves away on his own. He's sort of isolated from everyone while he's attempting to create his creature. He manages it. He puts the electricity through the body of the beast and he comes alive. But at that moment, Frankenstein, I don't know why he didn't realise before, but he realises, oh my gosh, what have I done? And he deserts his creature.
Oh.
Hoping that it'll just die.
Nice.
Through providence.
Nice.
And he sort of goes into, which is kind of, it's interesting because he goes into his own nervous breakdown.
Oh.
Which is why it's quite interesting with Tesla.
Yeah.
So he spends like, I think a year in nervous breakdown from what he's done, because I think he's just wrecked with guilt.
Yeah.
He's just constantly throughout the book, he's just horrified about what he's done. Like, he's just disgusted. This beast is despicable to him, and that's part of about how sad it is for the creature, because he doesn't die, and unfortunately he has to figure out life on his own, and it's really sad. So I think like about 2 years later, he eventually recovers from his nervous breakdown, goes back to his family. By the way, the book is all set in Geneva. It's not all set in Geneva. It actually goes to England, goes to Ireland, obviously the Arctic, where Walton is doing his studies in the beginning, but where Frankenstein lives, it's in Geneva, which is quite important because contextually, Mary Shelley, the author of this book, was there during the time that
I've actually seen her.
Oh, really?
Because I went to I went on a school trip to CERN.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We went on a lake trip. And it was like really snowy.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my god, this is like, oh my gosh. It must have been like, oh my gosh. I was so excited.
Oh my god, I have to do that. I know, literally after reading this book, I was like, I have to go to Geneva now. Yeah. I have to be on that lake.
And obviously, like, CERN was amazing as well, but
yeah,
the
yeah.
boat trip the bo- was, that boat was trip nice.
Oh, rude.
It's fine, we'll
that
go.
Would be my highlight. But yeah, so he goes back to Geneva to see his family, but he's been called there on unfortunate terms because I believe it's his brother has been strangled to death. Sad times. Yeah, not good. Yeah, so then someone who didn't commit the crime gets prosecuted for it and hung.
Nice.
Oh, not good. And eventually, this quite a climactic scene, Frankenstein and the Beast meet on Mont Blanc, a big mountain. There's a snowstorm. It's very atmospheric. Very cinematic, which is why I really hope that someone, or maybe me, one day is going to adapt this book properly, you know, with the Beast being more true to how Mary Shelley wrote him. So yeah, he meets him, and it's kind of the moment where the creature goes, why did you make me to desert me? Why did you forsake me for this life where humans will detest me? And Victor Frankenstein calls him a devil, you know. The Beast doesn't have a name, and I think that's quite important, yeah. The fact that he is just not accepted.
That's probably why everyone
way.
Thinks he's called Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Because we have to
give him a name somehow. So we're going to give him the name that his creator has. But it's really sad. So yeah, he then says, please listen to me. I've learned a lot. I need to implore you and ask you for something. I deserve something from my creator. I deserve a little bit of happiness. And so he says, but obviously this terrain is not good for your human body, because Frankenstein was, the Frankenstein's monster, was built to withstand diseases and harsh terrains. That was Victor's hope, that he was going to be able to reanimate bodies that could survive longer. So the Beast
then just thinks he can desert him and he'll die.
I know, it's really annoying and problematic in terms of, like, what would actually happen, but the story is kind of filled with improbabilities, but you're supposed to suspend your disbelief, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the probability that this monster would have lived, and then would have suddenly found, yeah. like, Paradise Lost and all of these texts to which he could learn English, yeah. it's all very unlikely, but the whole point is that if you can believe that a body can be reanimated, then anything is allowed in the story. So you kind of forgive all of the improbabilities of it. So then this part is when the seven chapters detail the Beast's very long and detailed history about what happened to him when Victor Frankenstein deserted him. And run through it, basically. He learns through sensationalism, which is an idea by John Locke that... it's kind of psychology, which is quite interesting. Loads in this book, so many literary references, all about philosophy and thinking, and obviously the science in it is really interesting. But this part where the Beast learns for the first time mimics the idea of John Locke, which was that we are born with a tabula rasa, a blank slate, and we only ever learn through our experiences in life. So, this is shown by the fact that the Beast literally learns... everything from the very beginning about what he can feel, what the sunlight can do to him, the coldness of the ground in Geneva, everything. Improbability, he finds a fire randomly and then realizes that that's good, and then like burns himself, I think.
Oh my
You know, so he just learns life from the very beginning,
because
he has just been utterly deserted by any kind of parental figure. Really sad. So he eventually just sort of roams around, figures some stuff out, figures that he can eat things, so these roots are nice, these leaves are not nice, he can't eat them. And eventually he finds himself in the company of a family called the De Lacy family, and he sort of hides in a hovel which is next to that house, and learns how to speak and learns about human interaction through his observation of them. It's really sad. I don't want to spoil the plot too much, but basically it's just really sad.
I know what happens.
Yeah, like, it's, yeah. Basically, at every point when the beast tries to introduce himself to humans, he is turned down, he is rejected, yeah, and really powerfully. Like, there's a point where he saves a girl from drowning, and her brother comes up and sees that this monster is like looming over her, his sister, and shoots Frankenstein.
Oh.
Frankenstein's monster. See, I'm calling him Frankenstein because there's no other word for him. He's like the devil of Frankenstein's creation. But yeah, it's just really sad because he has such a want for love, warmth, and affection.
Yeah.
And at every single point, humans turn him down. Oh, and it's really difficult. So he turns to murderous rage, and obviously he is the person who strangled Frankenstein's brother. Sad times. Yeah, and so in that pinnacle moment where they meet and he's talking to Frankenstein in the cave, he says, make me an Eve. Make me a companion who's just as deformed as me so that I may have just one person in the world whom I can share this horrible life with.
Yeah.
And, you know, the monster speaks so eloquently. Again, it's an improbability. Like, he speaks so well. Would not be the case, like, and realistically.
In films, he's like...
grunt, just destroying things.
Yeah.
No, he's an intelligent being. He can speak.
He feels a lot. Yeah.
And it's really sad, actually, that at every point. And even his maker just turns his back on him. Really sad.
So does he not make the Eve?
Yeah, so he goes to Scotland and he's in the island and he's making the Eve for the monster, the male version. But this whole time, the monster has been following Frankenstein and his friend all throughout his journeys, and it describes them in London, describes them in Oxford, describes them in the north of England, and Frankenstein's monster has been following him the entire time. So yeah, when he's in Scotland making the Eve for the monster, Frankenstein's monster comes and is sort of looking at Victor through the glass of the door in which he's working, and it just spurs him to go, what am I doing? I shouldn't make another monster so that they might create monster babies and then be a bane to the world. I mean, this female monster might not do what the monster promised, and she might go on to murderous rage, or she might not want to be in union with the monster.
Yeah.
And they can still, as a duo, be quite dangerous to humankind.
Yeah.
Which is to be fair. Yeah. Like, his reasonings are kind of right, but the problem is that I really think that the monster is right. He does need someone, and the reason why he is so malicious is because of how badly he's been treated. And I really think that if Victor had gone along with it, because at that point he sees the monster and he tears up the body he's creating in front of the monster. So it's just like,
oh,
fuck. And I think that's the moment where the monster completely turns his back on all humanity and goes into full revenge Terminator mode. I'm gonna kill everyone that you love and destroy and any joy that you can, because if I can't have any joy, how dare you go on with your life. So yeah, I am definitely on the side of the monster. I can see where Victor is coming from, but just have, like, take some responsibility for what you created.
Yeah.
Like, so annoying. So the monster says, I'm malicious because I am miserable. And that's definitely that's definitely true. Like, he has such a potential to be loving, caring, a normal, you know, in inverted commas, normal functioning human as well as everyone else.
Yeah.
But at every point he is made a monster. He wasn't a monster to begin with. He's made a monster by the fact that everyone is so nasty. And he says, "My vices are the children of a forced solitude that I abhor, and my virtues will necessarily arise when I live in communion with an equal." I definitely think that would have been the case.
Yeah.
Alas, that's not a great story, I guess, if it ended happily. Yeah. And he just went along with his Eve and ended stuff. But yeah, so it ends pretty tragically. And there's some more deaths, but I don't want to spoil stuff. Yeah. So yeah, going, sort of zooming back to Mary Shelley, the female author of this story. She is so cool. So when she's writing Frankenstein, she's only 18 years old.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
And what I just read out, can you even imagine a monster, first of all, saying that, who has had no formal education, really? But an 18-year-old girl in the early 19th century writing a sentence, "My vices are the children of a forced solitude that I abhor, and my
she
virtues..."
She is the monster.
Yeah, it's crazy. There's lots of readings into it. I could go on literally for 2 hours, just like you went on, but I won't, I promise. But yeah, so just going back onto who Mary Shelley was. She was the daughter of two extremely influential and radical thinkers of the time. Mary Wollstonecraft was her mum, who was one of the early feminists, and she wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Women, in which she said that women should be educated equally with men, and as you can probably imagine, she was very criticised at this time. She wrote it in the 1700s.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. Late 1700s. And unfortunately, she died giving birth to Mary, which is very sad. Mary Wollstonecraft's influence on Mary Shelley was enormously influential, because she read everything that her mum wrote. She read everything her dad wrote, who was also an influential political thinker. They both lived so radically for the time. Like, I think they married, but I think they lived with other people as well and had children by other people.
So just super.
Really way before their time. Yeah, super. But as you can imagine, especially Mary Wollstonecraft, was vilified by critics and turned into a monster, which possibly might have influenced Mary.
Yeah.
Probably did. Mary basically lived her life going to her mum's grave, to be honest.
Oh.
Reading there, writing there. And even meeting her later lover, Percy Shelley, who is, and having a kind of a scandalous love affair with him when she was only 16. So the place of her mother is extremely important. Even if she wasn't alive, she was an enormous influence on
Mary. I bet it was like her, like, thinking about bringing her mum back as well.
Yeah, there's lots of biographical, like, critical readings into the story of Frankenstein. But there's loads of stuff, and I think that it's not really that interesting to go what created Frankenstein, like what made Mary do this, because I feel like we don't really do that with male writers. We're like, oh, what influences would have this female writer had to create this story, when it's like, well, we don't really do that with other male writers.
Yeah.
Like, it was a part, everything it was influenced in her life that came to the point where she wrote Frankenstein. Because obviously there's a lot of people who credit her husband for writing.
Of course.
Right. Yeah, it's annoying. Because she couldn't publish the book as Mary Shelley. So it was published anonymously. Because if a woman had written it, then
damn it.
Obviously people eventually found out that it wasn't Percy Shelley, it was Mary. Yeah. Eventually, but yeah, still people bang on about the fact that, you know, Percy was a massive influence and he did a lot of editing and stuff, and so is it really
Yeah, but that's
her?
Just being an editor.
I know, exactly. It's a bit frustrating. But yeah, this is totally Mary's brainchild, literally. And so her life was really tragic all the way through, really. So she eloped with Percy Shelley at the age of 16. Mary Shelley was married. He was 19 at the time. He was married to another woman.
Percy Shelley,
her husband, was married to another woman called Harriet. And they eloped. They really disappointed her father, who, even though, like, wrote against the institution of marriage, said it was a false thing and it encouraged selfishness and, you know, money grabbing stuff. It's just it's not a union of souls, it's a union of money exchanging, and
which is very true.
Very true. But it's just amazing that he was writing all of that in the late 1700s and then into the 19th century. Despite his radical views, William Godwin was really disappointed by the fact that Mary had eloped and done this radical thing. Which even for the 20th century, eloping with a married man.
Yeah, it's a bit problematic.
At the age of 16, crazy. She was pretty wild. She actually had she'd given birth to a child in the time between, she had a child and then it died, and then she had another child who was alive during the time that she was writing Frankenstein. So she'd already lost a child, and she was the mother of a second, who unfortunately died as a toddler later on. I think it was after the year of the publication, William died, the son, which is really sad. In total, I think she had three baby deaths in her life, and only one of her babies survived during her lifetime. So this is we talked about how she's an 18-year-old, but in terms of her experience, in terms of how much she read, she is not a girl. She is a full woman born in, you know, tragedy. Mum has died.
Also,
never had that presence.
18 years old back then was different to 18 years old now.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And, you know, she was reading Paradise Lost, she was reading Don Quixote, she was reading the Greek, you know?
Yeah.
You know, this is a very intelligent woman who was born out of really intelligent parents, who has also experienced a lot of tragedy within her own life. Lots of drama. Harriet, the deserted wife, also has a child at that time, but she eventually commits suicide. And in the same month, Mary and Percy get married. It's just all really quite complicated and dramatic.
Same month?
In the same month.
Shit.
Harriet commits suicide and they get married. Ooh, it's rough.
Yeah.
Poor Harriet, really. And also, I think in the same year, I think 2 months before that, her half-sister had killed herself as well.
Oh.
So really, just quite a tragic life for Mary. Only 8 years later as well, Percy dies in a storm.
Oh.
It's all really tragic,
her
life, generally. But, so the thing that we all talk about as literary people is the inception of when Mary thought about creating Frankenstein. It's the fairy tale drama story that these four really powerful minds of the day came together in Geneva, which is obviously where the story is set and massive influence. So Percy Shelley is obviously there, Mary's there, her sister, her stepsister, so it's all very confusing, but Godwin remarried because he was like, a woman needs to mother these people. She was a bitch. And her offspring were problematic. So Claire Clermont comes with, she elopes with Mary at 16 as well. And Lord Byron, who was also a really influential poet, who you could suggest was the first ever celebrity. Poets in the day were like movie stars. They were really sought after people. You know, fangirls were Lord Byron. He had a lot of attention. And he also slept out of wedlock with Mary's half-sister. So, crazy. They were all having kind of very radical liaisons with each other.
Just being like, fuck your
In the early
rules.
19th century, which is, it's really cool. And it's why we always come back to it, because they were just such radical people. So they went to Geneva, had a long summer there, and unfortunately the weather was really bad. And this is the year, historically, that I think a volcano erupted somewhere, and soot just blocked out the sun for pretty much an entire summer.
Yeah.
So this was, what a great atmosphere for four. Oh, also, we always forget about, so there were technically five people. We always forget about Polidori, who was Byron's physician, like private physician, who wrote a story called The Vampire, which massively influenced Dracula being written later. But what also happens, poor Polidori, Lord Byron always gets the credit for that story. God, and we always forget about Polidori, and he was very much bitter about the fact that he was kind of second best to these great people. Oh, kind of ironic that I forgot about him.
I know.
But yeah, he's there as well. So all of these amazing great minds are meeting in Geneva, and the weather's shit. There's storms, there's no sunlight, so they're all just stuck inside for an entire summer. So they talk about philosophy and the meaning of life and science, and they decide to assuage their boredom.
Assuage, does that mean like?
To get rid of, yeah.
Okay.
They decide to dispel their boredom by creating a competition. Who can write the scariest story? Okay. Ghost story. And I think Percy kind of starts something, Byron starts something, but none of them are great. And every morning, Mary's asked, have you thought of a story yet? Have you thought of a story yet? And she's like, no, to her mortification. You know, she hasn't thought of something. but then there's this pretty crazy time where she has like a waking dream, like a vision, which I might read out because it's really quite exciting, of Frankenstein, or student, reanimating the body of a corpse. It's a really powerful image. Hold on, we can cut out me trying to find it in my book. Yeah, so she sees an image of the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion.
Oh.
Ooh, how atmospheric is that? So cinematic. Yeah. And I mean, it just sets up the entire trope of this mad scientist cranking some engine, and then boom, there's like this crazy scientific creature coming out.
Yeah.
Ah, so cool. So yeah, she kind of has this vision just sort of drops into her brain, and she's like, oh, this is really quite terrifying. Like, she's horrified herself by this. And then she's like, oh shit, I can write this for the story. Yeah. And she's like, ha, guys, I've got a story. So yeah, Percy does really encourage her, and is really influential in her writing it. But again, it's Mary's.
If it was the other way around,
you wouldn't even know about the woman who was influencing it. Yeah, annoying. But so he really pushes her to not just make it a short story, but an entire novel. And so she does. So I wanted to just talk about the scientific influences that she obviously brought into the story. So at the time, there was a guy called Dr. Erasmus Darwin, who's not the Darwin we know, but he did experiments and with galvanism, which led to the thoughts that reanimation could be possible. So in this time, they didn't really know what the powers of electricity could do, which is all very relevant to the fact that we were talking about Tesla earlier.
Yeah.
And so they really did think that possibly you could reanimate a body.
Because if you like put electricity through a limb, it starts twitching.
Yeah,
and
100%. Going on from that, some guys called Giovanni Aldini and Luigi Galvani, some Italian scientists of the time, did all of these, again, wild and morally questionable experiments on the dead bodies of criminals, of murderers, like really recently hanged murderers. They, coursed electricity through their bones, I mean their bodies, and they talk about how a jaw quivered and a left eye actually opened. So you can imagine seeing that and thinking, holy shit, like you could actually...
I mean, like, well, we use defibrillators.
Yeah, and it kind of does do that. It kind of does restart the heart. And,
Because, like, it does work on electrical pulses, but obviously not quite.
You can't quite bring back a dead body. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what they were obviously trying to do. So this was like a massive thing that was happening at the time that was obviously influencing Mary. She was reading the works of Humphrey Davy, who was another scientist at the time, who was talking about in a discourse of introductory to a course of lectures on chemistry. Who would not be ambitious of becoming acquainted with the most profound secrets of nature? Science has bestowed upon man powers which may be called almost creative. So, yeah, so these people were, at the time, really ambitious. Yeah. And Mary is really quite critical of that. You know, the story is not a positive thing about science attempting these things on dead bodies.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like, obviously I'm very pro-science and everything, but I think...
That's why we have ethics boards.
Yes. But obviously, yeah, you can understand how terrifying all the new science that was happening and these ambitions of men thrusting their, you know, their ambitions into things that, you know, we shouldn't be meddling with.
Yeah.
And this is really relevant. And I'm always going to talk about how relevant these books are because they really are.
Yeah, you know? It's so relevant.
It's so relevant. I mean, she says, essentially to science, don't get too big for your boots.
Yeah.
Don't try to command the power of God, because you'll only create a half imitation of it, which will be disastrous.
Yeah.
Basically, that's the whole story. It's like, don't stop it. We're not God, and we shouldn't try to be. I mean, that's enormously influential, and this book is pretty much the first example of science fiction that there is, and it's, you know, so relevant to the fact that AI is coming out. We are actually creating human consciousness, and should we be doing that?
Well, you know, consciousness.
Well, you know, do you know what I mean? Like,
people have been talking about consciousness since like the phonograph.
Yeah,
like that was literally, they were like, it speaks.
Captured. Yeah, but
like it, like people have been talking about that since then.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy to jump on that bandwagon.
Ooh, yeah.
But
no, but it's still relevant. Yeah. And it's obviously permeated the like consciousness of humans about how should we be creating creatures that might turn murderous against you. I mean, the whole plot of Terminator is the machines coming back to kill humans because we've given them sentience. So like in terms of science fiction, it's extremely influential. But also, you know, possibly, you know, should we be creating beings that could possibly, you know, get really pissed off that they made us, that we made them, I mean.
Yeah.
So also kind of feeds into a lot of my antenatal beliefs. Antenatalism is the belief that you shouldn't bring children to this world because they will suffer. This is a really controversial thing, and as I hold that personally, I don't criticise people for having children, but personally, I can't bring a child into this world for them to suffer. And this book just really hits that home.
I was literally like, I mean, because I'm not, like, I want kids.
Yeah.
But, like, so yeah, it's just like a...
Oh, 100%, like a personal thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, like, I love children. Like, I would be a good mum. And like,
you can be a godparent.
I have a maternal instinct, 100%. Like, my dreams about having children are just very powerful, but I personally couldn't bring a child in that would suffer. They would suffer.
The fact that this was written by a woman.
Yeah.
Like...
Who's experienced babies dying. Her babies dying.
It is very much like a creation... Because, like, see the whole thing about, like, women create... Like,
we create life.
Grow life.
And that has enormous consequences.
Yeah.
And I think that's just the fear of probably a lot of mothers, that someone will... turn back and say, how dare you give birth to me, you know? And I think sometimes we all maybe feel like that, you know?
Yeah.
I wish I wasn't here, because if I hadn't been born, then I wouldn't be feeling shit right now.
Yeah, like, you know, all the teenagers that are like, oh, I hate my parents.
Yeah, yeah, it's really relevant. Like, but it's a really powerful, book. Lots of really interesting parts of it. I like it.
Yeah.
So Percy actually was very influential in the creation of the character of Victor Frankenstein, in that he didn't influence it artistically, but a lot of his traits come from Mary criticising his sort of over-enthusiastic ambition. So he himself was really obsessed with chemistry, was really obsessed with electricity himself. Which is great because, again, there wasn't a division between between the arts and science in this time. I'm trying to find the bit where I wrote down about one sec. Ding, ding, ding. It's definitely not there. So yeah, he had the same fascination as the character does in magic and witchcraft and the possibility of electricity reanimating stuff and electricity in general. And one of his friends at Oxford was saying that Percy would show him the electrical apparatus. He begged me to work the machine until he was filled with the fluid. They used to call it electrical fluid.
Yeah.
It's obviously not quite accurate, but like I quite like that they call it fluid.
I mean, a fluid and a thing that flows. So if you take the kind of basic model of electrons flowing,
yeah,
there's a technical like loophole.
Yeah, it's obviously
but
not fluid
in reality. No.
In water, like that flows. But yeah, so he begged me to work the machine until he was filled with the fluid. So that his long wild locks bristled and stood on end.
Gosh.
And that is again such an iconic image that we have that is obviously permeated films about this this science and electricity and you know the mad scientist whose hair is sticking out. So that you're like Percy Shelley was technically the first the first image of that trope that now is so like so iconic of science. In this era, like this crazy machine going and then hair is all going off and being crazy. So I really like that. So this book is really good. I definitely get it. It's really influential in science fiction. Technically the first science fiction book. But it's also got a lot about the morality of creating beings that have consciousness. And, you know, I think it really comes home to me that people who are nasty, you know, in life that you come across, it's really easy to vilify them, to turn them into monsters.
Yeah,
but
like
if
Edison.
Like Edison, yeah. But if we just showed a little bit of love to people who have just been, for the whole of their lives, neglected and abandoned and had their backs turned on, perhaps, you know, we wouldn't have human versions of the monster.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, lots of people in prison are probably just people who have tremendous trauma, who haven't been parented very well.
And then they get stuck in a box with a whole load of other traumatised people.
Which just increases it and...
Yeah.
Oh, and they possibly create children that they in turn abandon because that's all they learnt, how to parent... And it just creates a horrible cycle. So maybe it was a good thing that Frankenstein didn't create an Eve to...
Maybe.
But, just...
It's just problematic.
So the morals to round up of the story are science, don't get too big for your boots, and be nice to people.
Yeah.
Ultimately, don't reject your children.
Yeah.
Because they go on be angry. And don't judge a book by its cover, because obviously everyone...
That is
away.
A very odd cover. The cover's like...
Yeah.
It's
a painting. It's from the wounded philosophy... Oh, God, it's a Greek name. It's not of Frankenstein, the monster. It was painted before it was written, but... Yeah.
Philosophies? By... Yeah. It's a cool picture. So, but
yeah,
I have anything to add.
And also, I just would really like to see an adaptation that properly makes the monster's character how it really is.
Yeah,
really go into how this is not a grunting beast, which is why I was gonna mention earlier. It's kind of ironic that film has adapted him in a completely monstrous way.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of the book is to be like... The scientist is the monster for not taking responsibility for his creation. And the whole point is that we should be listening to the monster when he's saying, help me.
Yeah.
I have all of these emotions that you do.
Yeah.
I have all of the same wants for love and affection that you do, but all I've ever been shown is disregard. So it's all kind of horribly ironic that film has just turned him into the monster that
he's portrayed as.
Yeah, which is like it's not the character.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. So I would really like to see an adaptation of Frankenstein where the monster is properly, you know, fleshed out and explored. Yeah. Possibly not his language probably shouldn't be developed as much as it is in the book, because it is just so unrealistic that it might make a bit like ridiculous watching.
Yeah.
But definitely would love to see a good adaptation of the monster.
I feel like it would work really well as a play.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
As well.
Also, so many, when you look at it in an atheist way, really interesting.
Yeah.
Mary wasn't an atheist, but you know, possibly God is what Victor Frankenstein is, and has just horribly run away from us because we're destroying the world. And
yeah, I haven't thought about that, but definitely. Yeah.
And still the warning that scientists are going too far into developments, I mean, nuclear weaponry is pretty horrific.
Yeah.
And it's just the you know, ultimately, you could see it as just the proud ambition of scientists wanting to do it because they can do it, and we've got a power that can destroy a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the Manhattan Project, like, a lot of scientists were manipulated, like they were saying, you know, they had these officials saying, if you don't do this, like, it's American people who are gonna die.
Yeah.
So they were like, bullshit, like.
Yeah.
But I think there were definitely scientists who just got so into the work that they probably were just like,
just so driven by the ambition of doing it.
In the end, it was probably a really interesting, in problematic air quotes, question.
Yeah. Can you have the power of the sun, basically, isn't it? Kind of.
Nuclear
fission.
On one level.
On what, you know. But having way too much power.
Way too much power.
And that was only in, you know, was it the 40s that they were doing it?
No idea.
That they were doing the Manhattan 1940s. So the technology now must be,
oh, we all gonna die.
We all gonna die from nuclear stuff.
We all gonna.
So the themes of the book are still so relevant.
Yeah.
Like, why have humans got this desire to create things that will destroy things? Oh.
Yeah.
Shit.
Biological counterbalances?
Yeah, probably. That's the one. my boyfriend was telling me about one of the quotes that some of the Manhattan people were saying, and that, you know, when they first saw the first experiment of the bomb dropping, like, it was like seeing the apocalypse and realizing that you're the creator of such. Can you imagine just feeling the guilt again that Victor has throughout the whole book?
Yeah,
he's just racked with guilt that he's done something that kills people.
Yeah,
and that's only, you know, he only kills like 6 people possibly, or 5 people.
Right.
He saves one person from drowning, but you know, nuclear weaponry kills millions of people.
I mean, obviously there's the argument that it saves a lot of people.
Yeah, because we're not having wars,
We're
still having wars, so it hasn't worked. Fuck.
Yeah. Although arguably I would say that that's probably why Iran and America didn't start a big war.
When
Trump killed that, well, not Trump, but like America killed
that
guy.
Was it the general of
the
armies?
Yeah. Arguably, like, the reason that didn't escalate into a full-blown war was because of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
I'm not for nuclear weapons, but from a logical view, I have to, like, I can see the for and against.
Yeah. Like, at least there's only been 2 nuclear bombs dropped so far in history.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that happened.
Yeah.
And it's horrendous.
Yeah.
So, obviously the book is kind of anti-scientific, but I think it's more anti-ambition going too far, I think.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
Not don't do
science. And science is exactly the same, like that. They have so many ethics boards because of this.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think there was something I was reading again. Endless trifling through my notebook, which you're just going to have to cut out. one sec. Anyway, sorry. But I mean, she said, frightful must it be for supremely frightful. Would the effect of any human endeavour to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world. So don't try and be God, everyone.
Yeah.
It's kind of the point. And, yeah, like, it's kind of disgusting that people were getting dead bodies and...
Yeah.
I mean, there was one study that, the Giovanni... Giovanni Gal... Wait, Giovanni... Giovanni? No, Luigi Galvani. I was mixing two people up. They, like, in one study, they put the electrical thing on an ear and then the rectum, and it, like, fully convulsed the dead body. I mean, this is pretty horrendous, you know?
Yeah.
It's not ethical, is it?
No.
At all. And I suppose the book is just relevant in the fact that, science has... Oh, no, I remember what I was going to say. I don't think I wrote it but what they were basically saying was that if science can only be good if it's working towards benefiting people, and if it oversteps that, that's when it becomes dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So science should only be looking towards enhancing people's lives, and it should only have like a positive...
I mean, I would argue that a lot of science is created and then other people adapt it for harm.
Harm, yeah. That's true.
Cause...
I agree. But yeah, I think it was basically like if science is not... It doesn't have good intentions, then it's going to end up bad. But I agree with you that you know...
Yeah.
The actual scientists are not... They don't care about creating horrible things.
No.
They just want to...
They're just, like...
Driven by the science. But then it's the manipulative psychopaths who see the potential of that invention to cause...
Or, like, pain. It's developed for one thing and then someone realises, hey, it's going to be used for another thing.
Yeah. Just like the electric chair.
Yeah.
Ooh. This is a good way to kill someone.
Yeah.
It's like, that obviously that wasn't the intention of Tesla. He wanted everyone to have electricity.
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah. So I suppose the whole story is just be careful.
Yeah.
And don't neglect your baby.
Basically.
Yeah.
Cool. 100%.
That's kind of it. Yeah.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed this episode.
Yeah, that's all from us for this week.
You can find us on Instagram at...
Interested.podcast.
Interested.podcast. Yeah. So we'll have lots of like images and more information and links to information sites, all that stuff on there.
For this episode, we'll have Tesla, who is quite handsome.
He was.
Looking up his photographs on the internet last night. Very handsome.
He was.
Quite dashing.
Please, if you enjoyed this, give us a nice rating and give us a review. It really helps
getting
the words out there.
Just tell your friends as well.
Yeah, definitely.
If you liked it. We're sorry if we're just super... We're super new to this.
Yeah, this is our first...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our first passable recording.
Yeah.
There's been quite a few.
Yeah, oh god.
But yeah, hopefully we'll get better. And I mean, maybe in the future, if people actually do listen, you could tell us what kind of things you want us to...
Yeah, definitely.
And we can do that.
Cool.
If we run out of ideas, which we probably won't, but...
No.
So yeah.
Bye.